Welcome to the award-winning Dare to Dream podcast with Debbie Dashinger, covering metaphysics, ETs, shamanism, and channeling. Here you will find spiritual inspiration from today's thought leaders, along with cutting-edge insights from our interstellar brothers and sisters and ancient shamanic wisdom. Now, here's a new episode of Dare to Dream with your host, Debbie Dashinger.
Welcome to Dare to Dream. This is the podcast that's on the edge of consciousness, where science, spirit, and the unknown collide. What if the Anunnaki were not ancient astronauts, but discarnate intelligences who altered human consciousness through sacred geometry, psychedelics, and esoteric initiation? Dr. Heather Lynn is here to unveil the hidden architecture of humanity's awakening. And by the end of this episode, you will understand how secret societies, altered states, and forbidden knowledge shaped the very mind you and I are using right now. So stay with us, because this is not mythology. This is the blueprint of who we became as humans, of consciousness itself, and why it matters at this precise moment in history. And to learn more about her, go to drheatherlynn.com. And I just want to bring up her amazing book, Anunnaki Revelation, Hidden History, Altered States, and the Mystery of Humanity. And with that, I bring Dr. Heather Lynn on to Dare to Dream. It is wonderful to have you here.
It's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. I teach some of this when I speak, because I am known for and I speak about shamanism and extraterrestrials. And of course, anytime you bring that in, either subject, there's going to be real history involved in how we became who we are. So I'm very excited to talk to you, the expert. And I want to start with you, Dr. Heather Lynn, historian of the human mind and author of this beautiful book, Anunnaki Revelation. You explore cognitive archaeology, symbology, artificial intelligence, and myth, very prevalent today. But you do it through a Jungian framework, or Jungian, however someone wants to say that. And your work reframes the Anunnaki not as mere, very tall physical beings. I'd love you to start with talking about how the Anunnaki were consciousness catalysts who actually transmitted advanced knowledge to a lost civilization.
Well, that's exactly what I think is going on with the story that we all know, I think, by now, of the Sumerians and their gods that are so mysterious. But in a lot of ways, they're not as mysterious as some of the other gods, because the Sumerians wrote everything down, and they wrote it down in cuneiform, which was on clay tablets. And those clay tablets withstood the test of time and are still able to be read. And so, to put it into perspective, there are over 500,000, that's half a million cuneiform tablets right now in museums and universities. Not all of them have been translated, but that's half a million. And we know that there are so many more buried that have yet to be discovered and translated. And there's a wealth of knowledge just hidden and waiting to be uncovered. And in comparison, you have the Egyptian papyri, and we don't have as many because they were on papyrus. So they didn't last. And so when you consider the vast amount of knowledge that the Sumerians have been able to give us, or at least have the potential to give us, there's all sorts of really interesting threads that could be pulled so that we understand our own humanity and trajectory. And it really does, at the end of the day, come down to consciousness. And that's something that I think is really important to tell people, because the most common story that we're, I think, popularly familiar with is out of Zechariah Sitchin and what he talked about with the Anunnaki being entities that kind of came down in spaceships that were very much metallic and nuts and bolts. And if you go and look back at those translations, though, we've learned a lot since then, because these were coming out in like the 1970s. And there's been so much more and so many more developments in the field of Sumerology that it's a little, I think, more nuanced than just that. I think that by focusing on them being, say, extraterrestrials from a different planet in that material sense, it doesn't quite tell the whole picture. And in fact, I think it obfuscates the real picture. And that's something that I wanted to do with the second book. The first book was Anunnaki Connection, and that's where I just try to figure it all out. Like, hey, what's going on? And I do an overview of the topic. But, you know, as they say, I found out there were more questions than answers. And so it necessitated me having to write this other book. And it took a direction that I did not anticipate, which was taking a look at what the Anunnaki were and the difference between the Anunnaki and the Apkallu. And this was where it got very interesting, because if you say do a general Google search on Anunnaki, you're going to see all of these images we're familiar with, the guys, and you know, they have sometimes wings or bird heads, or they're holding a pine cone, they're wearing the so-called wristwatches of the gods and holding a handbag, and you'll have so many different images of them, but not all of those are Anunnaki. And the ones that have the bird figures, those are Apkallu. And so what is the difference here? What is going on? And when you start understanding the motifs a little bit, it gets almost like how in extraterrestrial discussion, you have all the different so-called races of extraterrestrials. You have a bunch of different types of what we would call Anunnaki. So these Apkallu are where I kind of spent a lot of time focusing on what were these overall. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest the initial integration of the Anunnaki into the semi-settled hunter-gatherers at the time in Mesopotamia were likely humans, which is a little bit different than what we're used to believing. But a lot of the evidence suggests that these were individuals that came from a post-flood apocalypse. So after the Younger Dryas impact event, there were individuals that scattered and brought technology to different groups of semi-settled hunter-gatherers. And so what's interesting about this is when you look at the text of, say, Noah's Ark, the one most people are familiar with, if you look at the original in Sumerian, it tells a full different story. And that story is very specific. It talks about the Noah figure not getting together their family members and building a boat per se, and not getting all of the animals of the entire world together. But instead, it specifically says that they got together all of the heads of all of the different sciences and technologies and arts so they could make a breakaway civilization. And they gathered all of the animals of the steppe so that they could survive. And so you have something very almost Atlantean going on. But when you then understand, well, where did this translation get mixed up along the way? So when these individuals come, they literally subjugate the people that were already there by making them their slave species. They have them digging up different trenches for agriculture and irrigation. They have this whole priest class system that's built that says you can't speak to us except through this priest. You can't breed with us. So there was this whole, like, you can't breed with them. This is where we get this like Nephilim idea. They were altering our DNA, but as opposed to the traditional view that we've had in pop culture of them with like beakers and lab coats, and they're doing this technologically, they did it through animal husbandry because they looked at the people there as animals. And so they basically had eugenics, early eugenics. And so they did alter our DNA, but through selective breeding programs. It's wild. So we start this whole system where they're literally systematizing an entire reality on the people that were there. And they have this like this whole sacrificial system and a religious system that's different than spirituality. Because religion.
I want to stop you there. This is so interesting. I thought that they did much like the Greys did in the hybridization. Well, prior to the hybridization program, where the Greys had genetically mastered emotions out of themselves. And by virtue of doing that, they actually were not able anymore to breed children and sustain their life force, their people going forward. And so they realized we're going to have to make different choices. And that was a big part of the hybridization program. And so as they were doing that, yes, they were creating hybrids, but I thought that the Greys were also genetically changing themselves, altering themselves with what they were retrieving so they could start to incorporate emotions back into themselves. So all of this to say, I thought the same of the Anunnaki, that they literally went into our genetics and our DNA and were able with their advanced civilization to alter it. I didn't know it was more of a physical, manual change that happened over time.
It was.
And if so, how did, when you say the husbandry and we were the animals, how there must have been some crossbreeding going on.
Oh, for sure. And that was part of the fall because Enki was, they were told, no, you can't breed because they were trying to keep their bloodline pure. Now, again, they bring all of their systems to us, the human, so to speak. They were the ones who called us the black-headed ones and the Adama. They called us the Adama because they said that we looked like we were red, like the clay of the earth. And that's a little bit where Abrahamic faiths get this idea that man was made from God modeling clay, and then he was called Adama and then Adam. But really, what they were saying was that the individuals they encountered there, who are about 5 foot like tall at best, because they were hunter-gatherer still, they rubbed themselves down with the red ochre of that clay and they had dark hair. That was just their tribal ways. And so the Anunnaki referred to them as the black-headed Adama, the black-headed red people, and of the earth. And they said, we don't breed with them. They're our slaves. Well, over time, just like in the Abrahamic faith, you hear the idea of like they looked upon the women of Earth and saw that they were fair, and then came down and made the Nephilim. Essentially, they bred. Well, in the story of the Anunnaki, it was Enki that broke ranks and thought it had pity for people. And what he ended up doing was going to the individuals and teaching them, giving them enlightenment, teaching them language, teaching them the arts. And that's why Enki is often associated with sometimes the Promethean figure, but also the Aquarian. So because he's associated with pouring the waters of consciousness down to humanity. And it was the turn of a new age. Well, in doing so, it created a rebellion in the heavens. And then he was ostracized. And then we get these mixed raced individuals, and they are looked at as giants because, well, they were taller. We have archaeological evidence that shows the height of the people there versus the height afterward. And they were looked at with suspicion. And that's where we get the idea of the evil eye because they had blue eyes. And that's why those Sumerian statues will have very wide eyes that are made of lapis lazuli. And it's considered bad and scary because they were the bad guys. But at the same time, they had this system right in place of like enslaving people. They also had religious system. So rather than a spirituality, they made a religious system, and religion comes from the Latin to like relegate. You're like relegated to something. So it's like the rules. So they had this religious system, and it sort of exemplified though what they were believing, which was their spiritual system, which was different. And that was reserved for the priest class. And that involved these beings called Apkallu. And those beings were described as semi-biological entities that could come out of the ocean or come out from the sky. And they were known as the seven sages and associated with the Pleiadian star system specifically. And you don't hear that a lot with discussions about the Anunnaki, because Anunnaki is like the word Lord. Or like in other traditions, Baal, which there's a lot of people talking about Baal right now and thinking it's one god, but Baal was Lord. So there was like different types of Baal Zebub, Baal Hammon, and all of this. Well, likewise, you could say you have Jesus Christ as Lord, or you can have a landlord, the Lord of the manor. Well, Anunnaki ended up becoming a word that encompassed a lot of gods and a lot of different things. And there's a pantheon of like 12, and there's like higher order, then there's lower orders. And then over time, of course, because the Sumerians get invaded, they change and religious syncretism happens, and it goes into things that we may recognize like Ishtar and Venus. But the names change. But that earliest, I look at the very earliest evidence to see where did this actually come from? Because there was what academics call the Sumerian problem, which was twofold. One, how is it that in like a historic blink of an eye, 200 years, all of humanity, as we're told, was primitive. And then just all of a sudden we have civilization in 200 years. And then also the language problem, because Sumerian matches no other language in the region at all. And so it's called a language isolate. They have no idea where it comes from. So it came from elsewhere. So there's a lot of questions there. And so if we
Lot
look
of
at the, I know,
questions.
isn't it
Well,
wild?
let me ask you, because we're going deep, and I want people to know here at the onset who actually were the Anunnaki. Is it the story of Nibiru and their planet and the atmosphere? Were they guides? Were they manipulators? Were they ultra-terrestrials? How would you answer who they actually were?
I think it's all of the above. And I think it depends then on when you are looking. So I think the initial contact that was made was with human beings that had, I don't know a better way to say this, but perhaps possessed. I mean, that's probably the best way I can say it. They were shamans. Now, I say that because there's a ritual where they were assigned a sage once they became like this king. So they were given this special knowledge and they gave themselves up to it and acted like that entity on earth. And so whether or not, I mean, it's hard with the language we have now to say inspired means from the Latin inspirare, a deity would blow an idea into you. So, I mean, in that sense, they were inspired by, or they were possessed by, it's hard to say, but they were inhabited by these discarnate entities that they worshiped. And that's where the whole thing gets, wait a minute. So maybe if you were on the ground at the time and you see these individuals who are referred to as the shining ones come to you, they may have physical human bodies, but that's not the whole story. So, but what is inhabiting or inspiring them, in my view, would be ultra-terrestrial. Something that inhabits multidimensional forms and can take form because they are formless. It's a discarnate entity and they're looking for carnation and incarnation. And so if the system of the antediluvian sages that they brought in after the flood and started populating all around had this kind of this shamanistic aspect to it, you could see that then match in all of these different cultures, which we do. So we have things like being in altered states, having similar motifs, because they were reaching altered states, higher states of consciousness, and then spreading that throughout the cultures they were now subjugating, or some in some cases sharing, enlightening. It just depends. And so I think that's what we have is the Anunnaki were the flood survivors, and they were the survivors because they were of an elite class that understood and had contact with the ultra-terrestrial forces that have always been on the earth, in the earth, above the earth, and interdimensional.
Were they a rogue faction from the other Anunnaki doing something they should not have done, or were they actually sent to do a particular mission? And then recalled, if they were rogue, were they recalled?
I think they were rogue. I think that is one of the things that you see with the split between Enlil and Enki, very clear, is they did not get along. They mistreated human beings. They mistreated what they thought were their slaves.
They took away our will, right? They did
totally
to us
did.
And didn't ask.
Absolutely. And they forever changed us and our whole way of living that arguably is still at play today because we're part of a system. We're all part of the system and we've lost touch with the natural order. So they imparted that whole idea because the Sumerians are credited with inventing banking professions, the work week, the work day, math, science, like everything, which again, how did they do this within this blink of an eye? I suggest though, that once we go deeper into Göbekli Tepe, there's going to be challenges to that. And we're going to see that this is actually a phenomenon that goes much further back and that the Sumerian texts that we have are primarily based on oral tradition, which is why it gets a little murky, that it wasn't necessarily a firsthand account dated to that time, but a little bit further back, which is why it falls in line with the discussion of Atlantis through Plato's account of what Solon said. He said a lot of hearsay, but he said he discussed with an Egyptian priest in Egypt about Atlantis itself. So that puts it squarely at the timeline, though, where the Younger Dryas impact event would have occurred, creating a whole host of climate problems on Earth and creating people going like climate refugees, resituating. So rather than it being like Sumer is traditionally looked at as the start of civilization, I argue that it is the restart of civilization.
Wow, that is so, so, so interesting. You know, I heard something twice now that I want to run by you. And if you don't know about it, might be part of your next book. I heard someone was asking Daryl Anka, who channels Bashar. I don't know if you know who that is. Bashar is an extraterrestrial who comes from the Esasani planet. So it's a Sasani being, meaning it's part Zeta Reticuli, part human. It's a hybridized energy that comes through. And beautiful. I've been listening to him for a long time. He's been on the show many times. And somebody in one of the calls was saying, Why the Jewish people? I don't understand the history of the Jewish people. It's like baffling to me. It's still now, we're in modern times and still they're persecuted and run out of town and all the things. And at the time, Bashar said, the most I can tell you is that they have the highest degree of Anunnaki in them. And what happens is that people are not cognizant of what they're doing, but there is a very deep subconscious trigger to the Jewish people because they have an incredibly deep connection with the Anunnaki. And after that, I had somebody else on the show. I do many channelers, and Tyler Ellison, brilliant guy, who also happens to channel the Sassani. And I asked him as well, and he went way deeper, same explanation. So I
Wow.
want to know if you came across Satter, if that's just a fascinating tidbit that I'm sharing with you.
That's fascinating. I'm not familiar with the channeled material confirming that, but what is interesting is in my own research, I talk to a lot of people. I have a lot of people contacting me with information or things that they'd like me to look into. And it's been my understanding that that is one of the most important things to some people within that community is that they feel that they are attached to this Anunnaki bloodline, and that can be something very powerful, and they feel entitled to that, more so this idea of the divine right of kings. And that's one of the things that leads into this sort of subversive quest for the Tablet of Destinies. The Tablet of Destinies is this kind of fabled object that whoever owns it has the sort of code or key to all of reality and civilization. So it's more than just like a tablet of laws. It's a tablet of instruction, like an instruction manual for how to have civilization again. And so there's a lot of people with like money and influence that seem to be interested in finding that, researching the Sumerian kings list and associating them with that, for whether it be good things and then sometimes not so good things, because they feel that at the end of the day, it has to do with the divine right to rule. And so you can imagine then when people in positions of power hear that, they think, oh, that's my right to rule. And so you'll have people in Silicon Valley and other places who are maybe interested in funding some of these obscure archaeological discoveries.
Oh, that is so interesting. I love that you're even pulling in Silicon Valley into this. Amazing. I want to go a little bit because your book talks about plant medicine. And I mean, it's so fascinating what you've woven into this and what you've researched. So we're talking about the Sumerians. Did the Sumerians see mushrooms, psilocybin, as this conduit of communication between gods and man? Talk about the mushroom tablets.
Yes, that is a fascinating one that I was surprised about. If anyone's familiar with Allegro's Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, he sort of puts this idea together that Christianity was a mushroom cult. And he has this thesis, but he starts it off really discussing the Sumerian ideas and words and etymology, kind of that like are a springboard for that idea, but he doesn't necessarily develop them all the way. So I thought, that's interesting. I want to pull on that thread a little bit. And what I found was shocking because, yes, indeed, there were tablets that are called mushroom tablets because they're shaped as mushrooms. And, you know, when we think of tablets, sometimes we may think of the big Moses holding the Ten Commandments and they're big. But most tablets are very small. And most tablets are, in fact, rectangular and something like you'd write on. But these tablets were literally the shape of mushrooms and they had little writing all the way around. And what people would do with it is they would take that and put it into the temple wall as a way to say, this mushroom is what can get me communicating with the divine, very much like the Wailing Wall, where you put the prayer in and you put it very much like that. But they were literally shaped like mushrooms, which indicates that they did, in fact, see the mushroom as a direct line, like a telephone or something, right to God. And then when you put that together with these other practices that I argue come from this pre-flood sage class, that they bring these things in, like meditation, sound, vibration, plant medicine, and all of these things that we would consider to be shamanistic. And so there's evidence for that. I'm sure many people may be familiar with the pine cone and the image of this like strange rite Well, they also were wearing things that some people will call the wristwatches of the gods. And then those individuals that maybe lean towards Sitchin and have this very hard Cartesian science approach to it, where it's like, no, they were watches like an Apple Watch. I was like, well, what I found were the actual watches. And that was a discovery made by the local Iraqi professor in the region in 1989. And it was right before the war. And so he took a catalog of all of the artifacts found. And I'm talking gold like no one had ever seen other than King Tut's tomb. It was one of the biggest discoveries since. And since even then. So the biggest hoard of gold found. And he logged it in both English and Arabic. Pictures, everything for the museum. Great record of it. But then everything got looted, hidden, lost, as you could imagine, over the wars. And so I did find a picture of the actual cuffs, and they were stunning. They're not watches, but they kind of are, because they depict an actual rite that the king would have gone through with these apkallu, who are opening the third eye. And in the middle of them, and I have the picture up on my website, Facebook, all these things. I have a picture in the book. It's black and white, though, so I would suggest going looking for me online and seeing the color, because the color is astounding. They're beautiful. The intricacies were like nothing they thought they could ever have accomplished back that far. And so what they depict, though, are these little apkallu beings who are giving this anointing to the ruler, so that they would be able to now be in power to rule over the people. And what they were using, though, was plant medicine, in particular one that was based on the poppy. And that's why the watch has this look, and there's these little florets everywhere that in the West we were always told were just like maybe date palms or maybe just generic flowers, or there's been all kinds of things said. But the actual archaeologists from the region noted that, no, these were poppies, and not only poppy flowers, but the particular motif you see printed all over is when the poppy itself is in the pod form before it's ready to be having the latex removed from it. The very top of the seed pod has this very intricate floral look to it that matches all of the motifs in Mesopotamian art. And so you would take that out, and they called it the joy plant. And that was Hilgul. And so what we have here is a depiction of a christening of the Anunnaki kings by the apkallu, these strange entities, using the joy plant or the Hilgul rite to open their third eye. And then they could have all the wisdom needed to rule over people.
Wow. Wow. I have always said the most divine of all the things I've done is psilocybin. There's something very direct to the consciousness, the animism of nature, and also the divine. This is making so much sense to me. And I also sometimes follow the science of how they're discovering these earthenware in archaeology, and they're saying, oh, ayahuasca, going back 5,000 years, 10,000 years. And this was part of societies to connect with source, to start to transcend and bring back the wisdom and the healing. So were these psychedelics, these shaman practices, these altered states of consciousness used to communicate also with Anunnaki? And are they still?
I think so. I think that was the whole point of it, that they had these spiritual guides, and that's how they knew that they were able to commune with them through different formulas of plant medicine and different practices, different meditative practices, prayer, music, and that there was a system in place for that. And that was what they were protecting with their secret knowledge. But then later, Enki was the one that poured the waters of wisdom onto the individuals, and society became a little different because they weren't always then enslaved. And over time, you see the rise of all these civilizations and sciences, and it all spreads. And so it is definitely something that now we still see in the modern era. And that's why I talk about a little about the, Silicon Valley, because that is something that to this day, everybody's trying to leverage that and figure out how they can get in touch. I'm sure many people have probably heard all the stories of many different inventors and scientists over time, even Nikola Tesla, who claimed that their ideas came from somewhere else. And they were just making vessels for it. And so,
Marconi too said the same thing. Of course, they were made fun of terribly because they also talked about having met extraterrestrials. And at that time, that was not something you could talk about. So, I mean, he had such an interesting life of brilliance and loss and not being able to manage his money. And but absolutely, he and also Marconi transcended this reality to get the inventions that they knew how to create in this realm.
yeah, and that's that, in my view, is how we were able to get civilization and all of these things so fast, because these people were able to
Oh, that's beautiful.
communicate and then bring that technology. And since then, too, with the book, I interviewed a lot of psychonauts and people who had done DMT. And there was a theme that I saw over and over again where people engaged with these entities, these
Yes.
elves or what have you. And in some cases, they would say, come see something. I want you to see. They would show them something that they hadn't seen before, bring them technology and bring them some sort of knowing that they wouldn't have had otherwise. And so it could be that was a way that the ancients were able to cultivate or understand, have a shamanistic journey to then go get the new sciences that they could implement in the world and help us all ascend, both in the spiritual and in some ways the material world, through great feats of technology.
Talk about that. How did the Anunnaki actually influence the development of ancient technology or technology that moved us forward greatly and quickly?
So we have the material way, which was they were able to kind of take all the credit for being the place where everything from history starting, the writing system itself, to all of the economic systems and inventions that in some cases we still use today, like their surgery techniques for cataracts. They were doing successful surgeries. And that's it, too, where we get the idea of an eye for an eye. I mean, it comes from like the Hebrew and the way we understand it, but the predecessor for that
Yes.
was that was they had a medical malpractice insurance. And so they knew that if the doctor, it was taking out, they had a lot of cataracts problems back then. So if they were taking out a cataracts and it was like in the wrong eye or something, the penalty was the doctor had to lose his eye. So it was literally that, but that
Oh,
was a
you know what? That is so fascinating what you're saying. When I was younger, this is before tattoos were cool. When I was younger, I was 16. I really, really, really wanted a tattoo. Grew up in New York. I'm Jewish. I had many Jewish friends, but other as well. And we went out one night and I was expressing to everybody, like, oh, I really want to get this tattoo. And they were quoting to me so direct from the Bible. It was actually kind of terrifying. Well, you know, they say if you do something to your arm, you have to cut off your arm. If you do something to some part of your body, you have to lop that off. And here I am, just a impressionable kid going, whoa, all I wanted was a tattoo. This is like really intense religiosity. So I didn't do it. I did it much later in my life. But you are reconnecting something back to that moment I have not heard. And again, you are connecting Anunnaki to some kind of, it's in the Bible, but I'll call it mythology in the Bible or greatly misunderstood in the Bible.
Right. No, it is. And so that was something that when they discovered the Sumerian text, and the people who discovered it were in Victorian England, and a lot of them were very puritanical Christian, and they didn't want to upend the worldview of everybody by saying, hey, like Noah's Ark or some of the, most loved Bible stories actually were dated a little further back and a little different. But I always viewed that as something a positive. That to me didn't threaten. It just expanded the view of the faith. But that wasn't the view at the time. So they didn't keep it secret necessarily, but they didn't see a need to know. And so they didn't advertise that fact. And so a lot of people around that time didn't even think about the Sumerians. And we went through Egyptomania, and then the Sumerologists were working, trying to figure out the language. And thankfully it was so close to Hebrew, they were able to figure it out. And the rest is literally history.
History. Wow. This is so beautiful. I'm so excited to continue to deep dive with you in a moment. And I'm going to take a quick pause here, my friends, so we can go a little deeper into this work. And I've got something special for you for those who would like to learn about your galactic history, your cosmic lineage, and find out where you are from and what planets, cosmos, universes that you relate to in this lifetime, which are more dominant. You can get your free free star seed report and video, go to debbie-dashinger.com/starseed. That's Debbie with an I and Dachinger with a C. So it's debbie-dashinger.com/starseed. I am also speaking at the New Living Expo in April. Join us. Get your tickets. It's April 17th through the 19th in San Rafael, California. And that's at newlivingexpo.com. And if this conversation that I am having with Dr. Heather Lynn means something to you, hype the video. It helps. Your support by subscribing, by liking, by commenting, by hyping, helps us to reach way more academics, historians, but certainly star seeds and light workers around the globe. So allow us to feel supported by you, our community, and please hype, subscribe, comment, and like. Please do it. And thank you. I want to go back to something that was really mentioned mostly in your bio, but I think is so fascinating because, again, Heather, it brings us back to the now. These Anunnaki claims of the mastery of death and also formed our approach, you say, to AI, to longevity, to the transhumanistic quest for immortality. Can you intersect that for us, explain its inception, and how this weaves together?
Sure. It is very important because this was one of the biggest quests that I think that the ancient world had, that going so far back. You see it in the Epic of Gilgamesh, where, you know, Gilgamesh is trying to bring his friend Enkidu back to life and get this, you know, flower. We get the fountain of youth. We get all of these ideas always going back to what is it that can have life extension. And in some people argue too, that we did have longer lives in the past, or at least our divine influences have longer lives. And so it's just something that I think everybody has wanted to seek, but I don't think that the Anunnaki are a part of, like, separate from that. I think that was something that they understood actually pretty well, because they were on the forefront of medicine. And something really fascinating when you look at the Sumerian civilization is that it wasn't just that they knew how to have farms. They knew very developed and advanced forms of healing, including the medicines, plant medicines. They even made pills, and they had really interesting ideas about health and longevity. And so it was like part of the quest for a long time. But with the quest of just technology overall, you see all these different ways that people can be inspired. Excuse me. So when you have a long history of individuals using different practices to try to get technology, of course, we would want to know about how we can extend our own lives. But this is something that individuals have been doing for quite a long time, trying to get leverage and some advantage. But where I think that it really started to come together for me was when I started to learn about current individuals in the field of transhumanism. And this is something that, you know, even basic mathematicians or scientists, this is something that we may not think of them doing, but they do, which is they would have a question and then they would, like, seek the answer in the history. Again, we're often led to believe that the ancients were somehow just primitive and stupid, when really they were very wise and had very great grasp of the reality around them. They didn't have as much clutter. So there's a mathematician not too long ago who had a great mathematic problem, and he had all his graduate students trying to work on it, and he couldn't figure it out. So he went to the British Museum and went to their basement and looked up what the Sumerians had to say about it. And over time, he found the exact formula he needed that was never known before. And so it was there in the Sumerian. So likewise, the Sumerians have about 660 medical texts and journals where they were able to tell all the sorts of things of what's wrong with the body, or also what could heal it. And those things are being translated and understood. And some people have tried to go back and say, wait a minute, there's a few things here that say they extend life. What is it? And so, like, the Hulgil plant, the poppy, that took a little bit of sorting out, but there's other names of plants that we just don't know. So a lot of people are interested in trying to figure that out by A, looking at the text, trying to figure it out, but then also maybe bypassing the texts by channeling the entities who inform the text to begin with. And so we can do that and maybe see what they have to say and give us the answer to everlasting life.
How does AI come into this?
Well, AI, there's a few ways. One, AI has been used now to help speed that process up by translating Sumerian texts. And so this is a new frontier, has a lot of potential, but as you could imagine, probably a lot of problems too. But one way that people have thought that perhaps this could help with our life extension is to have instead of an individual be the channeler, we could have a system that has channeling built in to get that, to speed up that process. A lot of times it's all involving speed and like bandwidth. And so if you have, say, shamans or individuals, and they're doing this right now with extended state research by putting people on like DMT, trying to like extend that state for a while to see what they can do and explore on the other side and then take notes. But at the same time, it's one person and maybe another person, and it takes time. But if somehow, just like with the translation of texts, we could compress that, speed it up, maybe we would be able to have more significant downloads of information. And so in a way, that's what they're leveraging the AI for, is to maybe accelerate the process of ascension.
Oh my gosh, this is so amazing what you're pulling in here. So just so you know, I was recently featured in a CNN segment on DMT because I was part of the simulation / red laser experiment through Danny Goler. And also, I'm in touch with people who do the extended form of DMT.
Yeah.
And although I can't do it in April because I'm actually leaving the next day to travel, it is going to be done nearby where I live. And I'm going to sit for a friend of mine because he knows I am a shamanic healer and I can hold space and so forth. So I'm going to sit for him. And in fact, for the whole thing, when he starts and sets up probably an intention, and then when he goes under for however long that is, 1.5, 2 hours, and it is intravenous. And then when he comes out, you know, for him to come back and then do the integration, I am so excited for him. And I'm definitely excited in the future to do it. Originally, and this is typical of me, I'm scared of things, but I've been scared of everything I've done. And then I do it and it feels like the most natural state I could be in, interestingly. And so I was scared, the thought of it, like, oh, what if this happens? What if that happens, you know, when I'm under, and how do I communicate that, you know, something untoward is happening, any of the things. But the more I just go cognize over this, the more I'm getting very excited. And I actually feel like this will be a very important part of my evolution. So there may be some time I'll reach out to you and
Please
I'll
do.
Email you and say, I did this. And, you know, if you want to chat, I'm happy to chat.
I would love to. I'd love to have you on the show. I have a podcast and maybe I could talk to you about that experience. It'd be amazing. I'm very interested in that level of research and what people have to report back.
Yeah, even ayahuasca completely changed my life. Trajectory, what I do today, who I am, was wow. Not, yeah, this was, none of this was what things I would be talking about, but the divine came to me during a ceremony and she would not let up about who I was.
Wow.
So it's so exciting to me, this, how you're pulling this together, how you're weaving this, and even the way you just couched AI as a massive form of channeling. And I know there's a lot of polarization out there about it. There is, right? But because I'm in the spiritual community and so many people are brilliantly working with AI right now and having incredible results. They claim they have past lives, other galactic beings, themselves in the future coming back and communicating. I can't say yay or nay, but you know, when I've played around with it, I've had some positive, very suggestive things occur that were altering for me to receive. So
I used to teach a class. I used to be a professor, and in one of my courses early on, I was teaching about artificial intelligence and warning everybody that it was on its way to threaten the school, and nobody believed me. But then it finally, when it was more in the media and more discussed, I ended up integrating it into my course and teaching the students how to use it, how to use it properly. And I made my course where they would basically do a prompt, but then they had to show me the prompt, and then they would work out their thesis with the robot, so to speak. But then they had to work out the thesis with a human being and show me the questions and the interviews and prompts. And then at the end of the day, we compare and contrast the results and sort of do like a peer review. But I used to teach using it as a Socratic daemon as opposed to like a Google or a source. And then I tried to teach them how to use it effectively. And I got a little pushback, but I was saying to the advisors, I was like, they're going to use it anyway. The best thing is to understand how. So it's really like anything. It's your intent that you're bringing into it that will determine what comes out of it. So I think with artificial intelligence, there, I understand the polarization. But on one level, if we could somehow get everybody to be on the same ethical framework or same understanding of, you know, bringing your intention into it with goodwill, then I think the results would be much better. But then by scaring everybody and saying, no, it's bad, well, then you're going to have a lot of bad actors go into it and then alter it. And then it may be bad. It's neutral. It's a great tool. And it's what we bring into it that's going to matter and determine our ascension or not. So I encourage people to use it and then do so with that understanding that this is a great tool, but with the great, you know, reward is a great responsibility. And so do with it what you will, but it's not going away. You can't put the genie back in the bottle now.
Absolutely. The velocity is, it's pretty wild to watch. Yeah. You also, Heather, explore sacred geometry, acoustics, alchemy, and astrotheology as components of this transmission. Were these symbolic systems, were they practical technologies, or were they both, and how were they used?
They were both for sure. So they were symbolic because they had to be, because that's the way that they understood how to transmit it through our senses. So we could see things manifest in front of us, whether it be through geometry, but there was also the unseen component. So it was really just all of that condensed into one. So it was something to learn in like a philosophical and abstract sense, but then also something that was put into practice. And so you see that through all of the different techniques of music, meditative trance, the art and design. And so it was really pretty much a both kind of thing. So it's like, art itself is the container for the divine, and art is anything that a human is making, which is also why I suggest that artificial intelligence, artificial, it's something that humans have created, is not actually unnatural. It's just a natural consequence of the human creative capacity. And it also has then the capacity for the divine to enter it as such. And so it all has to do with that person's intent then. What do they want to have made with this? What is it that's going to come about from it? And so like any form of art, whether it's a beautiful building or it's music or anything else, it's using those divine principles, like as above, so below, to try to inspire or create a vessel for the divine to inhabit. And it's sort of a co-creation process then.
There also in your work, in your book, you repeatedly bring up secret societies. Talk about those secret societies. Who specifically were them? Were they, why did they come together as a secret society? Were they guardians of wisdom? Were they gatekeepers of power? How did they function?
Kind of all of the above, because there's different secret societies over time, and some got bigger, some fell apart. But the idea of keeping it secret was mostly out of necessity, because it would threaten the dominant religious viewpoint or the theologies and theocracies at the time. So in some ways, they had to be the gatekeepers. But also, because of their human nature, when you have access to that sort of power, it can also go badly. So some people took that power and tried to make themselves more powerful as a result. And then you'd have breakaway secret societies. So ultimately, though, what we have is what is esoteric versus exoteric. So most of us reside in this world where we think we're seeing what it is. But there's always been an undercurrent of secret knowledge that people have had access to, and they've kept people from, whether it's for their own safety, so they'll argue, or whether it's because they want to keep it for themselves, many different reasons. But those factions are often at war with each other. And at the end of the day, none of that, that's that priest class mentality where you don't need an intermediary. You can go right to the source. And so let them fight their fights and try to hide the knowledge. They can't hide what's hidden in plain sight. And as you know, it's often said, it's for those with eyes to see and ears to hear. And we don't need those intermediaries to allow us to know the secrets. We can do that through the ways that the Anunnaki understood, which was through these divine practices, through engaging with music, sound, meditative practices, plant medicine, contemplation, prayer, whatever people want to call it. And we can get those downloads and then we can have that ascension. But there are people in positions who get together in groups. I'm hesitant to say like Freemasons necessarily, because if you know a local Freemason, they're having punch and cookies and helping each other with business networks. But there are levels of Freemasonry that had been co-opted over time for nefarious things. But then so it's always just a battle of any time you have a group of people who get together with secret knowledge, they're going to be those who feel that they can leverage that. Same thing with Enki and Enlil from the very beginning. You have the powerful people, and then they wanted to keep it from the people at the bottom of the pyramid. But then you have those who are like, we are the holders of the light, and we believe that light should be offered to everybody. And that's through opening their minds and pouring through those waters of wisdom. And so that was like the original basis for a secret society. And so you'll always have that Enki Enlil kind of divide there between those who want to keep the secrets for their own benefit and those who want to expand our consciousness by allowing us to know that there are secrets to be had and showing us the way to find them out for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I think that archaeology these days is called to task because there's very archaic ways of doing archaeology, and there's a lot of that can't possibly exist in their culture. And we see this a lot with Graham Hancock and some of the others coming up who are doing some beautiful, profound work right now. For you, Heather, how does this Jungian psychology help decode the ancient iconography with, and also the myth, in ways that traditional archaeology often overlooks?
Great question, because I think traditional archaeology is often focused in that Cartesian materialist world. It is about the material things that we're touching and discovering. And often it gets hyper-focused on that and forgetting the whole point. Like, what is the story behind it? And so with the idea of having like maybe a Jungian component to it, trying to look more deeply at the objects and understanding their story or the people behind it, what they may have been thinking, trying to find that out through analyzing their myth and knowing that myth is not a lie. It's not fact, but it's the ultimate truth. And those are two different things. So there's observable scientific facts, and that can be found in the material things that you may dig up and be able to measure and quantify. But then there's a deep truth. And that's a truth that's literally magical, because the myth carries on past the time a person is alive, past different language barriers, past different cultures and time. And so that's what truly endures. And I think in a way that's threatening to the people who are only subscribing to the scientific model. And so I try to look at it that way more and then use the material to support what seems to be hidden and encoded in the myths. And so if you think about how magical myths are, I mean, even something like a story written 100 years ago, somebody had an intention there to make you feel a certain way, and they're long gone and, you know, past, and you read that story, but you feel those things that that individual intended. That's action from a distance. That's literal magical intent being played on you from a person who's gone for a long time. It endures after their death. So there's nothing truer than that. That is pure consciousness. And we're able to encounter that and experience that mostly through myth, music, and all of the beautiful arts that humanity creates. And so I look at that as the ultimate thing we're after. And it is a thing that ties us all together. You know, we have so many different, like Joseph Campbell talked about the hero with 1,000 faces. We get so wrapped up in the mask. We talk about our isms, so many isms, like all of these different things and all the ways that we're different. But when we pull those things apart and we look at the core, we can find out how truly connected we all are. That's the golden thread of humanity that runs between us all. And that golden thread is what's going to lift us all up into our future ascension.
Mm. Dr. Heather Lynn, this was so edifying for me, just not my mind, but my soul. Thank you for this, really bringing the conversation and the information. I want to hold up your book one more time for folks and tell us, where can we find you? What is next for you? And where can we get your book?
You can find me at www.drheatherlynn.com. It's drheatherlynn.com. You can find everything there. Books are in all major bookstores and Amazon and anywhere good books are sold. You can find me on YouTube. I have a podcast as well. And yeah, lots of fun stuff to come. So, and anybody, if you're interested in talking to, always send me an email. I may be slow to get back to you, but I'll always get back to you. I love to hear people's thoughts.
And again, this is the second book of her books, and she's got a podcast, drheatherlynn.com. And this is Dare to Dream, Heather. What are you next, Dare to Dream? What are your future dreams and goals?
My only goal is to keep spreading good words to people that may hopefully inspire them. And my major goal and wish for the whole world is, at this point, world peace.
Amen. Thank you, sister. Well, I end today's show with this reminder. If the Anunnaki were catalysts in the awakening of human consciousness, then our roots are not just biological. They are initiatory. So to understand them is not to worship the past, but to recognize the vast potential seated within us. In the upcoming weeks on the podcast, I'm going to be speaking with Debbie Solaris, the galactic historian, and also David Palmer, who is an astrology genius. He's going to be giving us all the collective and individual lowdown for 2026 and beyond. This has been Dare to Dream for curious souls, connecting with extraterrestrial life, higher dimensions, and ancient shamanic wisdom. Be sure to subscribe to this number one transformation conversation.
Thanks for joining us this week on Dare to Dream. Make sure to visit our website, debbiedashinger.com. That's DEBBIDACHINGER. You can subscribe to the show on YouTube and all major podcast sites, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this program, we'd appreciate a like and comment, or tell a friend about the podcast. That will help us out as well. And if you like this conversation, you might want to check out Debbie's shamanic healing programs. And Debbie is available for coaching to write your book. And her company takes your finished book to guaranteed international bestseller. Be sure to subscribe for our next episode of Dare to Dream podcast with Debbie Dashinger, your number one transformation conversation.